morning, marketers, and welcome to the If You Market podcast. We are the only podcast that markets the shit out of it. I'm Sky Cassidy. I'm the host here of the If You Market podcast, and today we'll be talking with Byron Crowell of Solutions Publishing about European lead gen in the age of GDPR. A lot of GDPR talk today. So Byron's the founder of Solution Publishing, where they produce niche journals to help connect technology vendors and project leaders. I think very relevant for this topic, why we have you on. So thanks for coming on today, Byron.
Good. How you doing, Sky?
So GDPR, it's a scary acronym for a lot of marketers. A lot of marketers, they just know it's this big weird thing. We don't like compliance and having to jump through all these hoops. But your company, it seems, kind of straddles the, well, you provide an old school solution before GDPR, what people used to do before all this data was everywhere, but also you've gone through all of this. So can you speak to the audience? I know very little. Our company just said we're staying out. Can you speak to the audience? I guess first, let's just start off saying, what is GDPR?
So yeah, the General Data Protection Policy Act is a European act that was passed by the EU. It went into effect in 2018. It was passed a couple of years before that. And it basically sets up a regulatory body that audits or is a place to receive complaints from consumers and businesses regarding breaches of privacy and or illegal it's more like out of compliance communications and prospecting without permission. And so it for the first 2 years it didn't really issue any fines, although it had the legal authority to do so. And then about a year ago, it started issuing fines, big ones.
Were they playing rope-a-dope, just thinking like, let's let people think we're not going to ever do anything and see who the players are, and then we'll go get them?
I don't think it was that. I think it's a matter of, you know, they have a giant sledgehammer, and I think they wanted to decide which way to wield it first for maximum effect. And also,
is that find a small business that's an easy target to crush, or go after a really big target to make a point?
Yeah, the second, right? The second, because here's the thing, right? Part of it is to keep the populace on board with this whole thing. And they have certainly done that in the sense that they've gone after Amazon and Google. They've gone after some other folks as well. But for the most part, it's all in consumer, right? We do B2B, and that, you know, to some degree is a different animal within this context. But they've gone after the big guys for the most part. What they've done for smaller folks is make the cost of operating a lot higher, because you have to be prepared to, if you get a GDPR inquiry, which, you know, we've been through a few of them, you've got to be able to turn your audit quickly and get the data back to them, get the information about where people opted in and so forth. And so, you know, that produces an infrastructure cost, and it produces a cost to, you know, be able to produce this stuff quickly and have it ready.
It's like a data tax almost, it seems like. You're creating this new barrier to entry for any company that touches any data. I think one of the things I said, I know very little about it, but I do know this, it's not just like my company's a data company. It's not just companies that sell data, that do direct marketing. It's, if you do anything other than like a hot dog street vendor, I don't know if they have those in Europe. Maybe they have like a waffle street vendor or something like that, cheese street vendors. If you do anything where you have people's information, then so it doesn't even have to be outbound marketing. You have customers. Mm-hmm. If you have their name recorded, then you have to be compliant.
No, it's true. Yeah, they made it so that if you hold information on a European or an EU citizen, you have inherited liability. And so, like yourself, like a lot of companies just said, oh, the hell with it. I'm not, you know, why deal with this at all? What's my lifetime value of that name versus the liability that's incurring to my company? So that, you know, and there are a few different facets to this thing. The first one is infrastructure related, right? So if you want to operate within GDPR, if you want to do business with European data, the first thing you have to do is go through a full infrastructure audit and retrofit to make sure that your data, the way you transfer data, is compliant, that you have procedures and policies in place, that they are documented, that your employees know about them. Because the first thing that will happen is if you get a complaint or an inquiry, is they want to see your policy and they want to see that it's been implemented, right? And you have to.
It's not just saying, yes, the data I have permission to have. Yeah. And if somebody calls that into question, then I can show it's you have to have certain levels of protection set up ahead of time. It's almost like they're an insurance saying, we need you to show before we'll even let you do any of this stuff that you can handle it.
Yeah. You've had to spend resources to some degree to show that you're, you know, on board with the whole program. So in our case, back in 17, like we looked at it pretty hard because we had a fairly robust European, you know, lead business. We had newsletters, right? IT Solution Journal was published in the UK specifically. It had its own version in France as well and in Scandinavia. So we looked at this and said, wow, you know, this is a big, you know, opportunity and also a big penalty if we have to, you know, give all this up. So
you guys don't just say, hey, we're all opt in, people sign up for us. So all we need to do is on our site, put a little extra checkbox about GDPR or something like that when they sign up. There's all this other stuff you had to decide to do to stay in the market.
Yeah, there didn't used to be, right? It used to be you get engagement, and engagement, you know, carried with it some level of permission. So that has sort of gone away there. So what we had to do is take our, you know, our database. It was 100 and something thousand people who would engage with the newsletters on a regular basis. And before the curtain fell, we sent all that to a call center and said, call all these people and get on the record that, you know, they accept this and they want it. And so we had consent by email. We had consent by phone call. We could show the audit trail of all the places before it ended that, or the, before it started, I should say, that, you know, these people are legitimate. We've been doing legitimate business. After that, it's very difficult to get new readers, right? You literally have to have a reg form and somebody signing up. And, you know, the cost of a new reader in Europe is much higher than it used to be. And, you know, you can debate whether that's good or bad or whatever, but you really have to do it. And because it's so difficult to prospect organically, you're essentially left with, all right, well, I got to go to LinkedIn or I got to go to Facebook or something like that.
You said you can debate whether it's good or bad. And I would invite anybody, because I hate GDPR. We didn't do any business with European data anyway.
Right.
But I still hate GDPR. I still think it's terrible. I think it's anti-capitalistic. I think it's anti-business. And when you say the curtain fell, it feels like a European Union wall came down around business. Just saying, we're going to make it really hard to do business. And then on top of that, you were about to get in, and I'll let you get into this subject as well. Yeah. But I think you were about to get into the subject of, again, the wall, it's not even an analogy, hardly, the wall they put around is a wall that big businesses can get around, small businesses can't. But also now these platforms, all the platforms that everybody's pissed about now, they have these walled gardens. And so for them, you're just forced out of the free market and into their marketplace. You're forced into Google AdWords. You're forced into all these other places to get your advertising because they can overcome these walls or pay the fines or whatever.
I think that's right. And you and I probably agree on most of that. The only thing I'd point out is that GDPR is very popular in Europe, right? So the public does not agree with us, right? As marketers, they feel like they're being protected or whatever. And so that's why I say you can debate it, but I don't think you can make a case that saying something like, you know, any ungated introduction online is illegal. If that doesn't sound like, you know, it's got a free speech problem to it, you know, I don't know what does. And we're not all the way there yet, but we're quickly becoming there where as soon as the cookie ban goes into place and the whole display piece of the puzzle is much less, open, then, you know, you're really stuck with being arbitrated by Apple and by Google and by Facebook and by LinkedIn, Microsoft, et cetera. And you either have to have one of the most compelling offers ever to make it, because you have to outbid everybody else, right, to be able to get a keyword or get in front of somebody.
Which again, steps on the small businesses, because you're going to get outbid.
Very difficult, right? Very, very difficult. And, you know, some agree and say, well, that's what they want. They want it difficult to be flanked by, you know, small, innovative companies. And so, you know, to some degree, it's doing that. So But the, you know, back to my my story, right? We went through that so that we have a you know, bank of 100,000 plus subscribers to get our newsletters. Therefore, we can, you know, still do some outreach. But you know, it shrinks. It's difficult because you know, data decays rapidly, even in Europe, where they don't switch jobs nearly as often as they do here. There's been COVID since then, et cetera. So I would say, you know, if somebody wants to do business in Europe, you know, you have to make sure that it's a worthwhile opportunity because the cost is pretty high.
And again, not just to market, it's just to maintain your clients and to right. have their information at all, right. which is insane. And I'm going to restrain myself from getting angry during this episode, but yeah. I feel like this law is terrible. And I'd like to go back, if you know anything about this, why was it implemented? What was the onus? I mean, you said something, Europeans love the law. I'm sure European business owners don't love the law, except for the very large ones. Right. It's funny, even the ones that are getting the fines are the large ones, but privately, they probably look at it and like it. It reminds me of I think it was the 1990s, they passed this law in the US. I believe it was the whole US, maybe it was just California, around the storage tanks that gas stations use, saying they all had to be replaced.
Right.
And these large companies actually came out for it. And it seemed like people thought, oh, they're doing this environmental PR thing, Exxon and all the big gas station companies are for it. And then what people realized once it was implemented was every single mom and pop gas station disappeared because they couldn't afford the cost to replace their tanks unnecessarily with new tanks. And the whole thing was really just this massive market grab, wiped out all the competition. The towns like mine went down to one gas station because, you know, small towns that had a couple mom and pops, it seems a bit like that, where they're going to sit. Complain a little bit about the regulation and at the same time backing it because they know it's going to monopolize the market for them. But was this a political thing? I see in some of these data privacy laws, there's some politician who sees a chance, you know, they need something to run on. And so they take this thing and make it their centerpiece. Oh, data privacy, all this. And they make this, and then they end up passing some law that's not really in the best interest of everybody, but sounds great as a bumper sticker.
It's hard to lump the whole thing into one agenda. I would say, you know, there were competing agendas that all, you know, were confluent at the same time. So, you know, it's hard to remember back since years ago, you know, years seem like decades these days, but back in 14, 15, in 12, 13, there were a lot of, you know, full on, data breaches where, you know, banks just got their entire user base stolen or taken or whatever. And that happened, it seemed like it was happening every 6 months, right? Some large company, Citibank would go and you know, then Marriott went and so forth. And so you could, you know, conspiracy theory can say, well, this is under the heading of, you know, let no crisis go to waste. On the other hand, you can say, well, you know, there certainly was a problem where all this stuff just is continually getting stolen and put it on the black market and the dark web. The fact that they lumped in B2B with the consumer, right? That's something that for the most part until recently we stayed away from in this country, right? There were consumer privacy laws that made sense. That, you know, I think most people would say, you know, that you know, you got to keep people, individuals who don't have the wherewithal to defend themselves necessarily, maybe a higher bar, more protection.
Right. But we have can spam, which says specifically you can send unsolicited emails, but you have to follow these rules. Right. We draw a line somewhere. They seem like they went the bumper sticker route where they said, let's just throw it all in there. Let's act like somebody's bank account number is the same as their name. Let's take this personal info data breach things and just throw in all marketing information, all account information of any type. This keeps coming up in episodes recently and talks and giving and stuff, but somebody's social security number or their bank account number is not, their password is not the same as their name and as their title and as their email address. Like, one is public information and the other is sensitive information. And they just seem to have thrown it all together because it all falls under the word data. And they didn't care to distinguish between one data and another.
Well, you know, they set up, this thing is set up as a regime, right? It's different than here where, you know, you've got a law and then
there's... That sounds like a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not how we do things, that's for sure. And I'm trying to be, you know, as sort of neutral as I can to sign, you know, because, you know, we do business there. So I don't want to...
Yeah. You can be neutral. I'll talk shit about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Okay. We don't want to pick advice we don't have to. But the thing is that this thing is a regime, which meaning they have broad powers. They have, in some ways, you know, they have some processes they have to follow, but they can do whatever the hell they want. And they're picking and choosing. And so I'll tell you, when we first started, right, we engaged with a GDPR law firm out of New York, and everybody was new to this, but these guys had done, you know, privacy sort of related stuff. And they were at the time, the experts on GDPR. And we talked to some other ones as well. And it was the strangest conversation. Lawyer conversations are generally strange with business, you know, business people, because we want an answer. We want, you know, here, cause, effect, what do I, you know, what's my liability? And they always try to not, you know, be a little amorphous. But in this case, it was, here's what you have to do. Here's what it says. Okay. And then what's your liability? We don't know. What do you mean you don't know? We don't know. We're not. And it's clearly intended that we don't know. And that we're all going to sit and wait until they start issuing fines. And then we will try to calculate based on that, what they will do in the future. But they are not constrained by those either. So that's why I say it is a bit of a, you know, a regime or a, you know, I won't get any stronger than that. But it's difficult to deal with because you can't predict necessarily what's going to happen. They could change their mind and policy decisions could be different. Next year versus this year, because there's some other thing that they're trying to cure or go after or whatever else. But for the moment, as it stands right now, right, we've had Amazon's ruling, which is $877 million. That's big even for Amazon, you know, and that's was around cookie consent. That looks like they're trying to find some sort of structural problem, kind of structural thing that they have, you know, mass offense going on. Google had privacy notices. There have been in Italy, there was a bank that went crazy with telemarketing calls. They got fined, but they come down pretty fast because 877 down to 6 million in the top five. So, right, there's this giant fine and that goes down pretty fast. All of these are related to infractions against consumers specifically.
Right. So the B2B space hasn't really been hit on that much, which is kind of strange. I mean, in our space and data, the biggest company in data is hopefully I can, they're very known to be litigious. Maybe that's why they took the stance they have. So hopefully I can say their name without getting a call from them. But Zoom Info's stance on it seems to be, we're B2B. It doesn't apply to us. We'll do whatever we want. And if you just heard a blank right here in this call, it's because I did get a call from them and they said that they would sue me if I use their, even mention their name. seem to just say, hey, we got lawyers. This is what we do. Bring it. We're not going to change anything.
So we're a Zoom Info customer and partner. So we love Zoom Info. Got nothing bad to say about Zoom Info. I don't know specifically about how they are defending their stance. They are offering European data, certainly. We use it to enhance our existing subscribers. We'll, you know, put it into to get augmented data that they have. But yeah, it's interesting to note that as big as they are, their market cap's now up to 40 billion plus.
Other than saying this doesn't apply to us, it seems, I mean, they're selling contact information of European people.
Yeah.
It seems so obvious. They just seem to be saying, you really want to test this on us?
Their contracts certainly make it, you know, to push liability on the user. And fair enough, I don't know that works with GDPR, but yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't gotten a comment from them, you know, recently about how they're looking at the whole thing. But I know that I certainly know it's on the radar, and I know that the last time we did a deal with them, GDPR was certainly a big part of the contract. So,
yeah, it's odd. It's odd how it seems to be applied around and not applied around. And like you said, the B2B companies aren't really the target. It's, you know, they're picking and choosing who to go after. We have actually seen fines, though. I know the first couple of years, all the talk was like, hey, nothing's happened. Was this just talk? Are they never going to do anything? Are they going to go after somebody? Are they going to pick big or small? Everybody was just kind of scared, not knowing how this was going to come about. And now we're still scared. We just know a little bit more about what they're going to do. Okay, there's a lot more to get to. I want to take a quick break, though. We're talking here with Byron Crowell about, am I saying your name right, Byron?
Yeah, that works.
Excellent. Okay. About the European lead gen in the age of GDPR. When we come back, I want to focus a little bit more on how to do lead gen with GDPR now, the actual what can and can't be done for people who want to market there. You're listening to the If You Market podcast, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the If You Market podcast. We're here with Byron Crowell talking about European lead gen in the age of GDPR. We've hit on GDPR a bit, Byron. Let's jump into this lead gen part. How do people do lead gen in Europe now? How do you market in Europe under GDPR, assuming we're going to follow the rules?
Okay, that's a good question. So the first thing you have to have is some level of permission. There's two pieces to the law when it relates to actual marketing in B2B. In B2C, if you have Hotmail or Yahoo or those kind of addresses, you have to have overt opt-in permission. It has to be auditable. You have to be able to show it. And if you don't, you're really, you know, taking your life in your own hands. B2B, you need to have some kind of permission, which would be engagement, a phone call, something that shows that in some way you had a relationship with this person prior. Prior to the implementation of law or going into effect. So that's one side. Then the other side is what's called legitimate interest.
Does that cover grandfathered in? Can we just say we already had their info? So
you still have to show it. You still have to show it. But the idea is that, so before GDPR happened, right, we went on a campaign to make sure we got documented, proof that we had talked to these guys and we could produce it. After went into effect, you can't just go call people and say, hey, will you take our newsletter, right? That game is over. So
you can't call them to opt them in, which is like in Canada, you call them up to opt them into email because they have the email, basically GDPR for email.
Right. So you have to have something, in place first, which is why, subscriber lists, that are legitimate of European folks are valuable now. If you can do, but keeping them up is really difficult because you have to, you have to do a lot of, add a lot of value, keep them in the
game. And that's a lot of what you guys do there at Solutions Publishing, right? You have all these, I'd say it's kind of old school. You have this pre-email marketing, pre-internet ads that you've built these, and I think back to, you get IT Weekly or some sort of publication, physical publication sent to you for free when you sign up. What you're doing is getting on the monetization part is the ads in the publication plus the monetization of the data, creating this pool of people who have kind of said, this is something we're interested in.
Yeah, it's a vertical email newsletters. And, we do a little bit more than that and, working on a lot more than that. But at the end of the day, that's what it is. The curated audiences that we, get engagement through email newsletters. So the newsletter has to be good. It has to be good content. It has to be, something people really want to read. Content costs money, right?
It's a traditional channel. I mean, it's just like TV or radio. It's just another channel saying, are we going to buy ad space in this magazine? Are we going to pay them to promote us out to their audience through other, email or whatever else? Or some channels, some publications like you guys would sell the list. Some wouldn't. They'd just sell sending flyers to them or whatnot.
So there's an example, right? Selling a list, that's out, right? No, you can't do that anymore, right? So you got to keep your list so your list is more valuable. You have people that are engaged with your newsletter. You got it in a place where, it's sort of a contained walled garden, as you said. And so that's our model, right? And that's how we sell some ads in the newsletters, but honestly, by far the biggest value is keeping engagement with these folks that are behind GDPR. So we can do lead generation. Mm-hmm. So if you have that, if you have engagement, then you need to have legitimate interest. So if we're doing, somebody comes to us and says, we want to sell tractors and we try to do lead gen and send somebody a white paper that's a cloud architect about tractors, no bueno. We're going to, very likely we're going to get a complaint about that and we'll have to,
But if you have a publication on farming and everything about farming, then boom, that's the vertical that now that lead gen can go out to say, with the assumption that there's interest because you're targeting.
Right. Legitimate interest. And, there's a test you have to go through. You can do what's called a legitimate interest audit, right? So there's a purpose test, a necessity test, and a balancing test. and they take you through how you have to do these whole things for each offer that you're doing. It's a pain in the ass, but that's what you have to do these things.
Like,
right?
That sounds like a shit ton of work just to say, yes, mm-hmm. I am going to sell soap on this daytime TV show because the audience that's watching is housewives and I know I'm going back to the 50s, but, and they're the ones washing stuff. So that's where I'm going to sell my freaking soap. You're like, no, you need to prove to us that that's who's watching and that they actually do have interest in soap and that they do the, it's like, come on, man, this is marketing one. We're just doing a targeted audience. We're trying to target as best we can. And you're taking that tool away from us.
Well, it's fair enough, but let's, you know, just to play devil's advocate, right? If you get 100,000 names of people that are quote GDPR compliant and you're sending newsletters to them and you say, well, hey, I've got one of the very few 100,000, name audiences there. I'm going to try to sell them everything. I'm going to sell them every damn thing that's under the sun. And I get every offer that there is because we have access. You know, that's what they're trying to avoid. So yeah, we sell tech products to IT Solution Journal guys, and we sell HR software to HR Solution Journal people. And that's for the most part how you're supposed to do it.
They're trying to avoid. They're vastly overreaching, in my opinion, and being terribly destructive to business. But they're trying to avoid essentially saying, hey, we have this list. Who cares what their interests were? We're selling Viagra. Some of them will be men. Let's just promote Viagra. So we have their emails. And according to us, we're allowed to use them. Let's promote Viagra out to everybody.
Exactly.
I can get that. Again, overreaching, poorly done, very damaging, but I can understand that argument as maybe they didn't have evil intent when they went and destroyed everything. Again, my opinion, not yours, but okay. So we have things like what you guys do there, where you have these verticals that you've identified and can get ads out to. We have the other marketing channels, like we mentioned, Google, Facebook, all those people can market through to. And stop me if I'm skipping over something here. But when it comes to marketing to people in Europe, there's the direct thing you were talking about. You get you curate your own newsletter, that kind of stuff. But there's all these indirect channels too, these own channels that you can kind of step. I mean, you could do billboards and TV ads and stuff still.
Yeah, and that's true. It's just the cost of acquiring a reader, a subscriber, has just gone up tremendously. So, and for the time being, there's still display, right? But they're going after that. So the cookie bans and a lot of the stuff that Apple's doing with, mass or should I say spoofing open rates and these kinds of things, all of these things make it more difficult to prospect somebody for something of value. Right. And so
we had somebody tell us the other day, they said, this doesn't make any sense. We did an email campaign and we got, this number of opens and this number of clicks. Why do we have 10 times the clicks? And I said, the way these things are measured now is insane. And, sometimes you get an insane amount of opens and a super low clicks and it doesn't,
frequently
it doesn't actually match across. They're measuring signals that may mean something happened or not. I mean, yep. A long time ago, Google started opening every email, preloading every image. So right. The image tracking stuff would show every one of your emails that went to a Gmail or a business Gmail was open and was clicked. But they all were clicked from the same IP, which is Google servers or the same group of IPs. Right. So just completely wreaking havoc on those kind of metrics. But you still have, even if you do all this, you still have a website, let's say, and you remove the cook, but you still have the back to the Mad Men style. Mm-hmm. You have a website. It's about sports.
Right.
People can pay to put up display ads relevant to the audience that would be interested in the topic on
the moment, right? So that's the problem.
You don't have
right?
to know who's there.
Well, so if the display ads, right? If the cookie bans go into place, and there's at this point, I'm not sure they can effectively do that because that's a bit of gnawing off your own arm kind of thing. But that's in some ways the last channel where you can say, okay, I'm going to buy a banner and get 100,000 impressions, and I know how I want to put it in market. I know what the interest of these folks. I'm going to match it up to a hash and upload it into Facebook or whatever else. But Facebook ad example, because that way more expensive, effective, but way more expensive. But in the general ad ecosystem, right? If you go to LiveRamp or something like that, you can get to some degree, right, still European readers. And you can still offer them a subscription to a newsletter. But, you know, the cost of the reader has gone up by 7 to 10 times. And so you've got to really look at the lifetime value of these guys and say, you know, hey, you better give them good content because, you know, you paid a lot of money to get to these people. And then, you know, what you have to do to get your money back over time is, you know, is pretty daunting. So it's a difficult thing because it really has attacked the freedom and openness of the internet and commerce in general.
You're still talking about targeting the specific target audience, about knowing who is, hey, here's the people I want to target. Only when they come, show them the ad. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, what's stopping sites, and some still do this, I'm sure, and some will, but you can still just go to this site is about sports. I have no idea who's coming through the site, but they're probably mostly people interested in sports since it's ESPN. So if I put my banner ad on that site,
yeah,
I know it's going to be this kind of audience. Doesn't matter who they are. There's zero cookie tracking, any of that kind of stuff. But I know my, just like TV ads, you know, I'm not only going to have it displayed to individual people, although I know that is a thing that has been worked on and there's some versions of it out there where each household sees their own commercial depending on their specific, who they are and their profile and everything. Right. But you just step back to, we don't know, but we know the profile of the type of person that would take this content. So we're just going to blindly put the ad out there. Again, less targeting, less effective, less useful for the viewer as well, but GDPR compliant.
There was no question there.
I'm sorry.
No, but it's a good topic, right? And the topic is something along the lines of, what is the ad ecosystem doing in response to all this sort of stuff, right? And that's not just in Europe, that's here as well. And so, you know, in the last 8-10 years, ad exchanges have come along and replaced what used to be the ad networks. And they're much more efficient and they're much better at serving ads quickly so sites don't get hung up. And they really do produce a better user experience. Now, you can argue about whether, you know, it's too creepy and whatever else, things follow you around. But I think it's their job
to balance the creep factor.
Sure, right, exactly. But objectively speaking, I think the user experience on these sites is better in general, where the ads are served elsewhere, right, at an arbiter or a third party or an exchange, and the sites produce the content and place the ads. That is now under threat because of exactly what you're talking about, which is, you know, they don't know if cookies are going to go away. They don't know how much, you know, having data or using data gives them future liability. And in Europe, they have a hard time even getting to the data. So as inefficient as it is, what you're seeing is media buyers and agencies are going directly to sites and saying, okay, well, we didn't used to, you know, we got away from doing this back in 2010 because it was so much more efficient just to place programmatic stuff at scale. But now we're going to go back to ZDNet, and we're going to go back to CNET, and we're going to say, hey, we want to do an ad buy with you directly. Here's who we're doing. But we know that you know who your readers are because it's first-party data. So that's some of what we're talking about here is first-party versus third-party information and access to audiences. And that is what we are trying desperately here to get to completely, which is first-party only a product for, you know, for our marketing partners.
So you're trying to keep it one step above the Mad Men. You're trying to not go all the way back to Here's the general audience that would be interested in this site.
Right. It's our audience, and that gives you a certain level of comfort because we're not informing it with, you know, there are a number of intent companies out there that will, you know, help you augment data as readers come to your site. They will augment and give you more information and insight about these folks. So that you can tailor content. Now, on the one hand, you can customize the experience, which is good. On the other hand, it's being used in other places. It's, you know, for things that users probably wouldn't want.
Right. You mentioned something there, intent, and I did want to make sure I got to this. How is GDPR affecting the intent data industry, which is basically saying for? Just for the listeners, intent data is basically saying, we're going to go and they call it internet exhaust frequently. We're going to go and track all these people all over the internet. Cookies are huge in intent, but we want to be able to say, here's a person I want to market to. Now tell me when they're doing activities that signal they might be interested in my product. They're talking to a competitor, they're doing this, you know, reading articles online on certain subjects. So they're basically following these, stalking these people all over the internet and reporting back to you about it for specific individuals. Typically, intent can be done a handful of different ways, but right. Intent is a very stalky industry. Are they able to do European Union stuff at all? How's that business working?
So the legitimate intent industry does things at the domain level, right? And so they use various ways. Cookies has always been the method of choice because it is at the individual level. But what they do, and this is US privacy too, and it works in Europe, which is, you know, you anonymize the data, right? You bring signal back about what somebody's reading, you put it in a server, you chop off the front end of the email address, all you're looking at is the domain, you categorize the content in some sort of schema, and then you say, how often, what is the standard deviation of interest in a particular topic over a certain amount of time over baseline? So, you know, Exxon is now researching CRM software because a bunch of guys somewhere at one particular office,
So they're going to say, we're not looking at the individual contact. We don't know who was, but we're not going to pay attention to who was. We're not going to look at that, but we know the company was, and then it's up to their client to either find individual contacts or then add specific target contacts on.
Right. And so it's used in a couple ways. The main use case for intent data is sales enhancement, right? So you want to do ABM account-based marketing. You want to say, you know, I have my product or service and I can't sell it to the entire world because it costs too much. So I want to take my limited sales team and send them after the highest value customers I can. So right. I can do two things. I can model my existing customer base, and then I can go to one of the intent companies and say, who's surging on these topics? And I can have them call those guys. The problem is that to do it, you have to consume PII. And so in Europe, that takes on an enormous amount of liability, whether you do anything or not, right? The compliance aspect of it when you're doing that kind of stuff is pretty onerous. So
is that to say you can say, hey, but we didn't keep the contact info, but you still had it at some point? Right. You taking it and then using it to do your thing and then getting rid of it doesn't mean that you're not still.
Doesn't mean they won't come and ask and want to see and all the rest of it. Yeah. So, I mean, I know a lot of the folks at intent companies, the biggest ones, and I can tell you that this is, you know, they've spent an enormous amount of time over the last 2 or 3 years figuring out how to navigate this stuff. And for the most part, they have made some marginal decision close to what you have, which is, you know, as much as we can, we just isn't worth it. Let's, you know, try to navigate away from it.
We're getting close to the end here. I want to see if I can buzz through a couple questions here for you. Are most companies complying with GDPR or just ignoring it? And you can decline to answer that question if it's legally not.
No, it's not that. I'm just trying to, when you say most companies, I would say that there's an enormous amount of small businesses and just, you know, folks that are, don't know what they don't know, right? And because they're so small and they're just, you know, kind of off the radar, they may never know and it may never affect them. I would say any company big enough to have a general counsel and, you know, have lawyers that will look at what they're doing will say, you know, that you guys have a big liability here, and they'll decide whether they want to roll with it or not. And there is an enormous amount of interest in GDPR from the lawyers that we work with. They're getting, you know, inundated with how people can become compliant. But for the most part, it's larger companies. So it's, you know, $50, $100 million companies plus. They realize that if they're going to keep operating, it's, you know, it's just too risky.
Right. Okay. And then are there winners and losers with GDPR? I mean, are there industries or specific companies that this is very good for and companies it's bad for, or is it just a mess everywhere?
Certainly there are winners. I mean, the big platforms are the winners. Now they're getting fined, but they're not getting fined nearly as much as they're being defended against, against encroaching competitors. I mean, you know, let's say, for example, if you wanted to launch a new social network, good luck, right? That's going to be very difficult to do with this new environment where there's nowhere out there to to get traction initially to get going. So, you know, Facebook's a big winner. Google's an enormous winner. And, you know, Amazon, despite $887 million, which is a lot for them, it's, you know.
That's an $887 million barrier to competitors entering there. It's basically a warning shot for them. They're like, oh, where's my couch? Let me get some coins. But to anybody who wants to get into that space, it's like, holy cat crap, we could be hit with this just the same.
Yeah, it makes things really, really difficult for sure. I think AWS is a big winner because they have already built in the infrastructure so that you can say you're GDPR compliant without doing your own, you know, building your own data center yourself that, you know, that does all that sort of stuff. They've got all that built in. I think individual data centers are in big trouble because, you know, they're just not going to be able to process anything, any kind of data like that. I will tell you that call centers, especially overseas call centers, they lost an enormous amount of business over this because they just can't call into Europe anymore. Nobody's going to hire them to do that. That is not worried about being fined.
What do you think about this? This I've heard the issue again. I haven't even bothered to dig into it much myself, but I've heard with GDPR that there's a blurry line between. Is this somebody living in Europe? Is this a European Union citizen, regardless of where they live around the world? Where does that line come? How much do people need to be worried that there's some Frenchman in San Francisco that they got the email of and now they're going to be in violation?
I don't know, honestly, Sky, because we don't do the consumer side of stuff, thank God, because, you know, I think that stuff is
got well, a lot on the more... business side, though. You have people who are citizen of the EU, but they're living in tons of people living in the US. And then you have non-EU citizens living in Europe. And it's like, does GDPR state a clear line on who's covered and who's not in that sense?
It says citizens, right? It says EU citizens. If there's a German that's working in San Francisco that gets an email and then sends a GDPR complaint to Brussels, good on him, I guess. That would be, how would you know?
More reason why I hate this law. I was worried that was the answer. I'd assume that was the answer. I thought that was, but it just seems insane in the lack of clarity and legality even of, I know.
There's very little due process. On the other hand, there's no fine. So you can say, well, okay, you know, we've been through four audits so far, or four inquiries, or, you know, we send somebody something or make a phone call and somebody's not up, you know, not happy, and they make a complaint and we have to go through a quick, you know, returning an audit, right? And the problem is that the client, right, whoever's buying the lead, they are freaking out because it's their brand on the line, right? So it's a bad 24 hours for everybody where, you know, you've got to dig all this stuff up. You got to make sure it's perfect, make sure it's right. You look at it, you're scared to death of, you know, do we really send this thing? Is it ready to go? Then you send it and then you're, you know, can't sleep that night. And this is what it produces, right? And in each of the four cases, it's been stressful. It's gotten slightly less stressful each time because now we kind of know what we're dealing with. And I think, you know, the Dells, HPs, and Microsofts, they also feel a little bit less, you know, like, oh my God, this one complaint means that, you know, whole marketing firm is going to lose their job. But yeah, I mean, it creates a lot of consternation.
Yeah, it seems, I don't know, that's, we don't have time to keep getting into that, but just the idea that somebody can complain and cause all this problem just by complaining. And now you're the one who has to go and prove stuff and jump through all these hoops. And
that's the general spirit of the law, is to make the marketer prove that they have permission. So
I don't like it. Okay. Let's change subjects here. We got a couple minutes left. I want to cover a little bit. I want you to tell the audience what you guys do. We've kind of touched on it, but I want to just talk about solutions publishing and you and what you guys do over there, unrelated to GDPR.
Sure. Appreciate that. So we do B2B email newsletters in the IT, HR, small business and finance and marketing spaces. We do most of it in US, but we also do some in obviously Europe, and we do Japan and Australia. And those give us a, the privilege of being able to do lead generation in those spaces. So one side is publishing, one side is content, one side is giving value to our readers. And the other side is we'll get, you know, lead generation campaigns from most of the major folks out there that you hear of and or their agencies. And they want, 100 cloud architects in the Northeast that are interested in, some new technology or piece of software. And we will serve a white paper to these folks and they will click on it or download the white paper. And then we have a pretty, extensive process of taking somebody who engages with it and then making sure and validating who they are, finding out if they pass the criteria for the campaign, calling them to see if we can get them on the phone and asking them more questions, and then shaping and passing that lead on to the client in a timely fashion. So
it seems like a combination of, you have the newsletter, you have an advertising channel, but then you also have kind of some intent, some lead generation. It's kind of all blended together into a, I guess, lead generation, but there's a layer of intent in there where you're creating intent by sending them the white paper and seeing if they interact.
Yeah, they get engagement, right. So, we get engagement by giving them good content over time, and then we try to determine intent by presenting them white papers or webinars or any piece of syndicated content. To determine if they're in market and interested, right? So there's in market, which means, they might be, have legitimate interest. And then there's actual interest that shows, yeah, this person, clicked on something and they've shown interest. So that's what we try to provide in our leads, more than just the kind of in market stuff that's out there at the very, very top of the funnel, or a little further down where, somebody clicks on something to read something.
Awesome. And did you mention the verticals? I mean, I think you focus a lot on IT space. Are there other spaces that you guys work in?
Yep. IT is the biggest one out there, obviously, but HR is huge for us, right? HR Solution Journal News is a great newsletter. And, we have 120,000, I think, US subscribers. And they're everything from, benefits people to recruiters to HR directors and anybody in that people space. Gets our newsletter and engages with that content. And then, we can serve all sorts of things with that, payroll software. UKG is one of our biggest advertisers and we do a lot of work for them. So that's a good one. And then finance, BFSJ, Business Finance Solution Journal, and then B2BSJ, which is B2B marketing. And so that gives us two things, which is it's an audience that, we serve a lot of content to for VPs of marketing, advertising folks, and also media buyers at agencies. And then we can also tell our story to those folks as well, because, we've delivered some good value.
Awesome. Yeah, that's your audience that you're hitting on there. So you have your own built-in market. Of course, you want to have that one going. Fantastic. Well, so for listeners, Solutions Publishing, if you want to find them online, it's SolPub, SolPub. We'll have more information on the company and Byron as well on the ifyoumarket.com website in the show notes for this episode. But any last things you want to throw out there, Byron, before we sign off?
I would say, if you're interested in GDPR, don't just say no to it. Reject out of hand. It certainly requires some effort. Now, it requires some effort, but it is doable. You can navigate it. And, if you have a good offering, it's worth it to look into, what is required. It's not the end of the world, but it does require some effort. And if you have a good partner that can help you get access to prospect folks there, then, it's a doable endeavor.
Fantastic. All right. Again, check the show notes, ifyoumarket.com. Check out soulpub.com for Solutions Publishing. And hey, when you go to If You Market, when you listen to the podcast, please do give us a review, share it around. So on behalf of the If You Market team and Byron Crowell of Solutions Publishing, thank you for listening to the If You Market podcast, where we believe if you market the shit out of it, legally, they will come. Are you looking for new leads or always in need of quality contacts for your marketing campaigns? But list companies and online tools are the worst, right? Well, then you've got to check out Top Data Search by Mountaintop Data. At Mountaintop Data, we're a team of weird people that actually like getting our hands dirty with sales and marketing data, and we specialize in business contact information. We compile and maintain a database of tens of millions of targeted high-quality business decision makers with emails, phone numbers, mailing address, and all the information you need.
Go to topdatasearch.com and request a free account with the promo code IYM1000, like if you market the podcast here, and get a free account with unlimited searches, no seat fees, and 1,000 free record download credits. That's topdatasearch.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.